Welcome to College, Conflict, and Civil Rights. What attorneys need to know about Title IX, 504, and campus discipline. I'm Samantha Seves, and I'm one of the membership chairs of the Barrister Section of the Beverly Hills Bar Association, and I'm delighted to introduce today's speaker, Nancy Potter. Nancy is the founder of Potter Law, where she focuses her practice on education law and civil rights advocacy for students across the educational spectrum. From early intervention to post-secondary institutions, with over a decade of experience, she represents students and families in a wide range of education matters, including special education, Title IX, and campus discipline. Nancy also serves as an appointed advisor, independent hearing officer, and external investigator for both K-12 and higher education institutions. Her trauma-informed, student-centered approach emphasizes practical, legally sound solutions to help clients navigate complex institutional processes. Nancy, thank you for being here and take it away.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. Good morning, everyone. As she said, I am Nancy Potter. I want to thank the Beverly Hills Bar Association for inviting me to speak today. Today, we're going to take a deep look at the laws that protect students with disabilities in higher education and how those rights intersect with college disciplinary processes. We'll look specifically at Title IX, but also more broadly at those processes. I'm going to use real case illustrations that are combinations of cases that I've worked on and practical tools with the hope that you all can walk away knowing, at the very least, how to identify those legal issues early on and know when a student needs help, but also to protect student rights and provide effective legal support when things do go wrong for our students. Next slide. And she did such a wonderful job of introducing me. I can skip over that one and we can go to our agenda for the day. So we're going to start by laying just a foundation of what the disability rights are that apply in college from a federal standpoint. Then we'll talk about 504 in campus discipline and then 504 in Title IX. Lastly, we'll talk about the campus discipline process itself. And then I'll give you some practical and strategic guidance for what to do if these issues come in front of you. So let's begin with laying the legal foundation. Next slide, please. Okay, so anytime we're talking about education law on a federal level, we are going to have something about privacy come up. So I just want to note this piece. FERPA is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. Essentially, it protects the privacy of education records at federally funded institutions, which are almost all public and private post-secondary schools. For students with disabilities, it governs how disability documentation, as well as Title IX reports, disciplinary records are handled and shared, including with parents and third parties. So at the end of the day, what FERPA does for post-secondary students is that at the very least, students are entitled to notice before a school shares their information. But most often, they're required to provide permission before the school can share any information. So that's just a baseline. We'll get more into how that applies to our students and disciplinary matters as we go. Next slide, please. Okay, now the next foundational law I want to talk about is Section 504. So Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act prohibits disability-based discrimination by institutions receiving federal funds. Same idea, post-secondary, that means almost all public and private universities. In college, it means that students with documented disabilities are entitled to what's called reasonable accommodations that provide equal access. There's no advantage of falling under 504. It's supposed to equalize that field. There is, however, a really a key shift from K-12. Colleges do not initiate the support. So when you have a student with disabilities who perhaps has an IEP or Section 504 plan in the K-12 setting, the school district the student lives in has a responsibility to identify, test for those sorts of things around students with disabilities. And then you have an entire team that's made up of parents, the student, the school, all working together to form the IEP team or Section 504 team, where they come up with a plan for the student. Now, in college, students must self-identify. They must provide documentation to the school. And the school's required to go through what's called an interactive process with the disability services. Section 504 is really our foundational civil rights statute that prohibits discrimination on the basis of disability in any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And like I said, this is done through reasonable accommodations. Another term you might heard use and what is used in the statute are academic adjustments. So the idea being that Section 504 requires these post-secondary institutions to provide qualified students. So you have to qualify as having a disability as defined by the statutes with equal access through reasonable accommodations and academic adjustments. Next slide. Thank you. Now, how does that apply to college students? Like I said, the students themselves need to identify themselves to the school. They need to request the accommodations that they want. There's no responsibility of the school to say, these are the accommodations we think you need based on your disability. Instead, the students really have to say what it is they want. The students, like I said, have to raise their hand and notify the school that they're a student with disability. Typically, that's through registering with the college's disability services office. It might be called the accessibility office. It might be just called the 504 coordinator. There's a variety of ways that that can be named. And then another piece, going back to the FERPA, is that that student information remains confidential. And so what that means for the student on a day-to-day basis is that a professor may know that you have gotten an accommodation like extended time on exams, but the professor doesn't know why. The professor doesn't know what the disability is. All the professor knows is what accommodation that professor has responsibility for, and they don't know anything beyond that. Students cannot, this isn't just about classwork. So students cannot be excluded from other non-curriculum academic programs, cannot be excluded from extracurricular activities because of disability. And the kind of the test here is colleges are required to make these reasonable accommodations unless doing so would fundamentally alter the nature of the program. And that's really what that interactive process is about, is an opportunity for the disability services and the student to have a conversation. It might be verbal, it might be in writing, it might take place in one meeting, it might take place over time, about what the student's recommending, and then the school itself evaluating whether or not those requests are reasonable under the standard, and then providing the accommodations to the student. The last thing I just want to note about college students in Section 504 is that 504 does, like all of our federal civil rights statutes we'll talk about today, include a prohibition against retaliation. So students who seek to assert their rights under Section 504 have a right to not be retaliated against by the school or any of its personnel. Okay, next slide, please. Now we're going to talk about what the ADA is. So the ADA, it really works in tandem with 504. The Title II of the ADA applies to public universities, and then Title III covers most private institutions. Similar to Section 504, but it really focuses on expanding protections to cover physical access, housing, digital access, and more, not just academics. Both the ADA and 504 require that individualized consideration, a preset accommodations menu, or a rigid refusal without engaging in that interactive process violate the law. the student's needs have to guide that response, and there has to be that evaluation of reasonableness. I think what has been newest around the ADA has been digital accessibility. So I know the Office for Civil Rights for years, probably 5 years, have had many, many, many complaints made to them about website inaccessibility, and have issued many agreements with schools to bring those websites into compliance with Section 504. Okay, next slide, please. And again, how the ADA itself applies to college students. The students are entitled to those reasonable modifications. The physical accessibility is really important and still comes up often, because it's not just about, you know, having an accessible elevator in a building. But if we only have one chemistry lab on campus, and for some reason the chemistry lab isn't accessible to a wheelchair user, that's a problem. And that still pops up, as does accessible like housing and paths to get to places on campus. It could also come up in the context of housing. So students might say, due to a disability, that they're requesting housing in a specific area of campus, or single housing being guaranteed for them. Dining, technology, all of those things must be accessible. Like I said, the ADA Title II applies to public universities, and then Title III covers most of those private colleges and universities. Okay. And again, like I said, as is the case in most of the statutes, and certainly the ones we're going to discuss today, there is that anti-retaliation language as well. All right, next slide, please. Again, this is just for you all to have as a resource. I wanted to go over what those core rights are, how specifically they work, those differences from K-12. And then lastly, you know, what's the first steps if a student believes that their rights are being violated? Always the school is going to have and is required to have some sort of a 504 coordinator who has to be available through a grievance process. So checking your student handbook, checking the policies and procedures of the school, figuring out who that person is, and filing a complaint directly. They certainly take verbal complaints often, but of course, the best case scenario is that if a student has a problem, they're putting it into writing, an email, asking for a meeting, and then going and seeing if they can figure it out. There's the Office for Civil Rights. While it has recently undergone a massive staff reduction, they are still working. Those career professionals who are super passionate about this work are still there and still addressing complaints. So certainly filing a complaint with OCR or the DOJ about a violation of 504 or ADA is available. And then education rights attorneys, we work on these matters often. I will say that, and I'll probably say this numerous times today, but something that's really important for Section 504 or ADA violations or complaints is, much like many other things, it's always easier to address the issues up front before they become a problem. So if a student asks, for example, for some certain test accommodations and the school denies it, and then the student takes that, goes through the semester, and perhaps ends up failing a course and now wants to file a grievance, that's much more challenging for the student to be successful with than if you ask for those accommodations or adjustments up front. And then if you're not awarded them at the time, to go ahead and go through the grievance process then. Next slide, please. Okay. So I just want to go a little bit more in depth of this post-secondary accommodation process. Because this process, if it's done with fidelity by the school and used by a student and their support system who knows that it's there, can really, really avoid a lot of the problems we see down the road. So once again, the first step is the student discloses a disability. That could be through a letter from a physician, It could be, you know, some schools have a portal that you enter into. Some schools, you know, when you come for freshman orientation or freshman enrollment, they'll talk about, you know, breaking off to see the disability services office and talk with them. But the main point here is, again, no one is going to be looking at students' records to see if they have a disability. You have to raise your hand. And sometimes I work with students who perhaps either didn't have an identified disability when they started school, or subject to some, you know, illness or accident. They have a disability that comes to them during college. So most recently, a couple of months ago, I worked with a student who unfortunately had a traumatic brain injury. And even though he was going into his last semester of school when that happened, he'd never had accommodations before. He still needed to request accommodations for that final semester. So again, that self-disclosure does not have to happen before school starts. It does not have to happen at the beginning of your academic career. And it may be a disability that you had either never had or had never been identified prior to you coming to college. But no matter when, the only way the school can find out is if you tell the school as a student. And then part of that disclosure to the school is providing documentation of a disability. And honestly, schools really vary widely of what they accept for that documentation. But most often a school is looking for, if you have an evaluation, that's wonderful, a prior evaluation, perhaps from the student's secondary education. IEPs and Section 504 plans are great documentation. While the school, you know, won't and doesn't implement those, again, it's good documentation. But even if you don't have that formal like psychoeducational evaluation, or you didn't have an IEP or a 504 plan in secondary school, doesn't mean that you don't have documentation or that you don't have a disability. So that's, a lot of students come to me and they're concerned that they need to pay for this big psychoeducational evaluation solely so that they can get their services. But that's not the case. Once that documentation has been provided to disability services, which will include the requests for any specific academic accommodations that the student's asking for, then it's up to disability services to evaluate that documentation. They're supposed to engage in what's called an interactive process, and then make a determination as to whether or not they're going to grant the requested accommodations. The other piece of this is, not only does a student have to raise their hand and say, I'm self-disclosing my disability, the student also, once they get those accommodations approved, typically the student is the one who provides those accommodations, information that they need those accommodations to their professors. So sometimes disability services will forward the student a email that they can forward to all their professors, letting them know what their accommodations are. Sometimes professors want you to bring a hard copy. And some schools have a portal where the student can give permission and select professors specifically that the accommodations go to. But the student's accommodations are only implemented if the student asks for them. And what is really challenging, and I see unfortunately too often, the students coming to me after perhaps failing a course the semester and say, well, I had accommodations, but they didn't give them to me. And then my first question is, okay, great. When did you ask the professor for the accommodations? And the students just have no idea. They're like, no. I registered with the office. They gave me accommodations. And, you know, that is a place where things kind of fall through the cracks. And I just want to note, you know, there is some really strong case law out there. One case in particular that is a First Circuit case, but really speaks to how a process should work anywhere is, you know, the fact that if the student's needs evolve or change, the school must re-engage with the student if they ask them to. And that can include when a student enters a disciplinary process. So we'll talk about that more. And then the other piece is that it's really important that institutions provide those individual assessments and don't rely on generalizations. So like I said earlier, it's important that the school doesn't just say, here's our menu that we always approve and move on. And I will note there is a Ninth Circuit case that came out about 6 years ago, 2019. I was about to say just recently, but that's not recently anymore. But it really highlights the obligation of post-secondary institutions to recognize and respond to these accommodation requests, even if not framed in precise legal terms. So this is a Rogers v. Western University case. And it's a very helpful case because the Ninth Circuit really emphasized that students are not required to use any magic words when seeking accommodations. They don't have to say, I'm looking for a reasonable accommodation or an academic adjustment. They could instead, you know, show up and say, well, I just need some extra help, or I'm not sure how to handle this situation. But as long as they identify themselves as a student with a disability, they don't have to have any other magic words. All right, next slide, please. And this is just a handy little chart that I often use with parents when they have a student who is transitioning from that K-12 education IEP into post-secondary. The laws are similar, though the IDEA does not apply to post-secondary. There's an accommodations plan in college, not an IEP or a 504 plan. And all that responsibility is with the students. The one thing I really want to identify and highlight here on the chart is the parent involvement piece. So in K-12 education, in every state, parents have legal rights and a decision-making role that's protected by the law. That means they have access to their students' information. That means they're able to call and ask for documentation. They're able to have meetings without the student being present about the student. Parents do not have that automatic involvement in higher education. And this is something that is so frustrating and so hard for so many parents that I talk to, particularly when you have a student who's struggling at school, or you're concerned about their well-being and you're unable to get any answers. So ways to get around that, of course, is schools have FERPA waivers. You can have your student sign a FERPA waiver before they leave for school. Almost every school is going to have one on their website. The challenge with that is that if your student then decides they don't want you to have access, they can, of course, get rid of that at any point they want to, also in writing. And sometimes even with the FERPA waiver, I should say not sometimes, oftentimes, even with a FERPA waiver signed by the student, that only means the school will include you in conversations. They certainly won't have conversations without the student. And just question just popped up about the first circuit case. That's Wynne, V. Tufts. And that's a First Circuit case from 1991. Okay, next slide, please. So non-Title IX campus discipline, we're going to talk about before we jump into Title IX campus discipline, because Title IX is just an entire other animal unto itself. The thing to understand first and foremost about campus discipline processes, regardless of whether you have a student with a disability or not, is that those discipline processes vary wildly by institution. At the end of the day, you know, there's very few requirements on what a school's disciplinary process must have. And that can be super frustrating, mainly because what most state laws hold is that a student discipline code has to follow a student its words, its policies and procedures. Common allegations that I see from students: academic integrity matters, especially more and more and more with AI and kind of these battles of how AI can or is being used. Disruption of campus life. And then alcohol and drugs. The process of general campus discipline typically involves kind of some basic due process rights, The student should get a notice of what the allegations are. There typically is some sort of an informal meeting with a campus administrator. And then that campus administrator in that informal meeting may be the one who's making a decision whether a violation happened. And if there was a violation of the student code, what the sanction is going to be. So that can be a little tricky for students. And really, they need to know this going in. If you get accused, for example, of an academic integrity violation by a professor, most often the first step in that process is that the professor makes a finding against you. And then if you disagree with that, you're really appealing to some sort of a board or another administrator to overrule that. So it's really important that students walk into those meetings with professors knowing that it can have that sort of a long-term effect. The due process standards can differ at private institutions. And one of the things that varies wildly, but is actually pretty popular in California, is around limiting how advisors and support people or attorneys can interact with students in this process. So some schools prohibit attorneys entirely. Their policies and procedures, their student code will say that if you have one of these conduct board hearings or some sort of a conduct informal conference, you're not allowed to bring an attorney with you. Some will say you're not allowed to bring anyone with you. Some say you're allowed to bring a support person so long as that support person is a member of the campus community. And then I saw one not too long ago that even said you can bring a support person as long as they're not an attorney, and that includes your parents. So if your parent is an attorney, they cannot be your support person in the meeting. Those limitations are, you know, allowable. Even when an advisor or an attorney is allowed to be present in a meeting, they nearly all prohibit those advisors from speaking. I explain to my clients when I'm working with them that once we're in the meeting itself, I'm really a potted plant. But unfortunately, students often do attend these alone or unsupported, even though these are very high stakes meetings. I do want to note that students can really benefit from preparation, even if it's a meeting where they're not allowed to bring anyone with them. And then in meetings where they are allowed to bring a support person or an advisor with them, there's always the opportunity to take breaks and speak with that advisor or support person in private. Okay, next slide, please. So we're going to look through a particular situation through the eyes of Marina. Marina is a biology major with ADHD and has anxiety. She's registered with both of those things at a private university. She has testing accommodations, but nothing that addresses anything around executive functioning or communication devices. Mid-semester, she was accused of cheating. She used her phone during an open note exam to access a time management app that was recommended by her academic coach. The professor reported her directly to the student conduct office, and neither he nor the student conduct office consulted disability services. Marina requested that she be able to bring a support person to a disciplinary conference, and that was denied. Her disability context and her direction that this time management app could be used from her academic coach was ignored. She was sanctioned, placed on academic probation, and received no further accommodations or discussions about that. So I just want to pause there just to point out some red flags. You know, here I would argue certainly the law wasn't followed. But also there's just some practical best practices that could be put into place that weren't happening, not because the institution lacked a policy, but because no one coordinated. Next slide, please. All right. And right before I jump into these, I'm just going to answer a couple questions. Have I ever requested an exception to the rules prohibiting attorneys as a reasonable accommodation, or prohibiting returnees speaking as a reasonable accommodation, and how successful are those? I have. I frequently make that request as a reasonable accommodation. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in our next example student. But certainly there are situations where I ask for an accommodation, either that I'm allowed to read the student's own, you know, opening statement or personal statement, or if a student has, you know, is registered as a student, maybe with anxiety. Recently, I asked for an accommodation just that the student could bring a support person and it'd be me because the school didn't allow support people. So I have had success requesting those accommodations. They're not always approved, but my experience is that schools, once I get involved, tend to be pretty flexible about allowing accommodations around the process. And then there's another question about what if you have a minor child taking a college class. So absolutely, and I'm sorry to make this clear in the beginning, the issues about FERPA limiting access is for students over the age of 18. What happens is that at the K-12 level, parents are entitled to information, even if the student is 18 or older. But at the higher ed level, that's very different. And, you know, I have worked with students in the past who are not as young as this question asks, but who are 17 and were freshmen in college, and had a lot of pushback when the school, when the parents wanted to get involved in conversations. That's less of a FERPA issue and more of a school culture and policy issue. But yes, that certainly would not apply to a K-12 student who's taking college classes. Okay, so here are kind of four big chunks of where we see some legal failures for Marina. First of all, at no point was there a consultation with disability services. So again, really important that the school has set up some means of communication between their student conduct office and their disability services office, so that if a student's, you know, name comes through, some sort of flag gets thrown to know at least that that student is registered with the disability services office, and then have the ability to ask the student or give notice to the student that you're going to contact disability services office. In this situation, there was no individualized assessment as to the denial of the support person. So she asked for a support person as an accommodation. They immediately said no. Again, their response in this particular situation was, sorry, that's just against our policy. We never allow that, no matter what. And saying we never allow that no matter what is not a legal compliant response to a request for an academic accommodation. And then, you know, just this overall situation that the disability context was ignored. So she had a coach, an academic coach that had been assigned to her through disability services, who had suggested that she use this time management app on her phone. And they had specifically set up a part within the app to help her with time management during exams. And no one had communicated to either disability services itself or her professors that being allowed to use this time management app was a reasonable accommodation that she was allowed. So it's really important, again, to remind our students that if they find something that's working for them, that's outside the formalities of the accommodations that they've already provided to their professors, they need to go back to disability services and get those in writing. I always tell students, we can depend on your written accommodations. We cannot depend on personalities who might not be there tomorrow. So that's really important. Okay, now we are going to talk about when Section 504 and Title IX intersect. Next slide, please. Okay, so first we're going to talk just a brief overview of Title IX. The first thing I want to say before I get into really the weeds of this is that Title IX as a statute prohibits sex-based discrimination in education. That's broadly. A lot of issues that are happening right now and changes in the law and trying to figure out policies is around how Title IX does or does not protect students who identify or are identified as LGBTQ. Also pregnancy and post-pregnancy protections for students under Title IX. I think most of us hear Title IX and we think athletics. So all of those pieces are very, very important parts of Title IX. And I sometimes do day-long trainings on each of those discrete parts of Title IX. But for today's purposes, we're just going to be looking at these grievance procedures inside of a Title IX process that apply to a student disciplinary matter. So in recent years, I personally have seen a spike in cases where student behaviors tied to disability are really misread as Title IX violations. Title IX prohibits, like I said, sex-based discrimination in educational programs. Again, those receiving federal funds, which is almost all public and private post-secondary institutions. Compliance should be enforced on campus by a Title IX coordinator. Again, I will say OCR is still there, so filings with the Office for Civil Rights. I'll also note that, you know, while Title IX is, of course, not a state law, many states also have state-level agencies where you can file similar complaints with them, but they're not quite the same. The big part of Title IX and the regulations that apply to what we're talking about today with discipline is Part 106 of the Title IX regulations. So that really goes in specifically to procedural requirements for Title IX compliance. That includes investigation protocols, notice requirements, evidence requirements, hearing and appeal rights, and access to advisors and accommodations. In the course materials, there's a link to really the most notable section around those grievance procedures if you want to follow up and learn more about that later on. And then I also included just some important and easy to read resources that are still in place from the U.S. Department of Education. So OCR put out a question and answers regarding the final Title IX rule that went into effect in 2020. They also have just a letter, what's called a Dear Colleague letter, which is just guidance to schools, again, how they implement these significant regulatory changes that were made in 2020. That included updated definitions of things like sexual harassment, changes in jurisdictional limitations from before 2020, and then how these grievance procedures could apply for employee-related complaints. Okay, next slide, please. So for Title IX, as it stands now, colleges are required to have some sort of a grievance system where a student, again, applies certainly to more than students, but today that's just what we're talking about, where a student can file a formal or informal complaint of sexual harassment or misconduct with the school. Typically, an initial assessment is made by a Title IX coordinator as to whether it qualifies as, you know, what are defined as these offenses under Title IX. Sometimes something might not be sexual harassment, even the allegations themselves might not be sexual harassment by Title IX's definitions, but they may be sexual harassment under the definitions either of the school's policy or their own state policies. The Title IX regulations require written notice of the allegations to both of the parties. So that's an opportunity both for the complainant or the complaining party or the reporting party, all the same person, to make sure what they're complaining of is captured accurately, and then also gives that notice to the respondent or the responding party of what the allegations are. In the investigation itself, there must be evidence gathering. There must be the opportunity for the parties themselves to participate in an interview, and also the parties to request witnesses be interviewed. And then similarly with evidence, that the parties have the opportunity to provide evidence and also review the evidence that is submitted by anyone else, witnesses or the other party. At that point, the report is put together by the investigator that is to be issued to both parties. And there's certain timelines about how long they have to review those reports and respond to them. And then once a final report is issued, the hearing typically is scheduled. This is a live hearing that includes cross-examination. So under those regulations that came out in 2020, schools are required to hold live hearings and to have cross-examination available. And the students must have an advisor to do the cross-examination for them. Students are not allowed to, the parties are not allowed to cross-examine each other. At the end of the hearing, the parties are entitled to a written determination, and there must be an appeal process. I would say, in general, appeals are very challenging because the reasons why you're allowed to appeal are very, very narrow. Okay, so let's talk about my client, Jordan, just, of course, not his real name. Next slide, please. So Jordan was a student I worked with at a large top public university in the South. Jordan was autistic. He had registered with the school as a student with disabilities, and he received testing accommodations, quiet room, extended time if needed. But that was it. There were no accommodations related to like class seating, behavioral supports, or anything around letting his professors know information about his disability. His third semester at school, a classmate in a large lecture hall class filed a Title IX complaint against Jordan. That complaint alleged that Jordan had paced outside of their classroom, watching her before class and after class. It alleged that Jordan had sat near her in class every day, and she was taking that as interpreting that as some sort of stalking. She also alleged that Jordan was masturbating in class. Jordan would tell you that the masturbating wasn't happening, but that all of those were self-regulation strategies. So, you know, Jordan paced out in the hallway before class because it was a way for him to get his energy out, a way for him to get physical movement so that then he could go into class and sit and be still and able to sustain his attention for the duration of the course. As far as seating is concerned, Jordan sat in the same seat in that classroom for every course he had had at the university, which included multiple courses, both that semester and semesters before. And then the masturbation allegation, Jordan had a STEM. So when he was trying to pay attention, ways that he would help himself pay attention. And one of those ways is that he would scratch his leg. Now, it was the top of his thigh at that crease in his leg. And so from where that student was sitting on the far side of him, certainly could have looked as if he was touching his genitalia. But in fact, that was not the case. So he did what he was. First of all, he was immediately suspended from campus. The complainants reported this to the professor in class. The professor was appalled because he had no, you know, reason to, he didn't think he had any reason to think that any of those behaviors could be explained or could have been innocent in nature. And so he immediately reports it to the student conduct office. The student conduct office immediately puts him on an interim suspension. Eventually he's, and we're going to talk about this in detail, he's denied a communication support person. His medical documentation is dismissed. He loses an appeal to get back on campus and is found responsible under Title IX and suspended. Fortunately, Jordan came to me. We were able to do an appeal and we were able to be successful in that appeal, where the school's internal grievance process acknowledged multiple procedural errors and disability bias. So, next slide, please. So these are some of the clear legal failures that we were able to be successful on in the appeal, which, you know, was wonderful to be successful in that way, but certainly was hugely disappointing that it all could have been avoided. Again, when this complaint came in, there's conversations between the student conduct office and the Title IX office, but no conversations, no way for anyone to know that Jordan was a registered student with a disability. Because of those FERPA laws, you know, no one had ever told his professor about his disability and how that might manifest itself in a classroom setting. So, you know, again, that wasn't a failure of the school, but working with my client and his parents, we were able to, you know, come to the agreement that in the future, it would be better for Jordan, individual assessment, that the beginning of the semester, he sent his professors an email and let them know that he has some physical behaviors that are not problematic and certainly are not, do not interrupt class, but that some people might not be used to seeing. So to let the professors know about that. He asked for communication support both during the investigation and during the hearing. That was denied. Again, it was just said, we can't do that because we don't provide that to the complainant. So we can't provide that to the respondent. So there was no individual assessment. The investigator had no disability training whatsoever and didn't coordinate or consult with anybody in the disability services office, despite Jordan asking them to. Same was true of the hearing officer. Jordan had asked for a set of reasonable accommodations, which included having the hearing officer meet with disability services or a professor at the school who had some sort of expertise in students with autism. And that was denied as well. Okay. Next slide, please. Some other breakdowns that happened. You know, this I told you about how he was immediately removed from school. That was not done with any sort of an individualized safety assessment. So Title IX says if you're going to remove a student from campus, you have to do, and it before the process is completed, you have to do this individualized safety assessment. The school did not do that. They set his hearing during finals week. And initially, when he asked for it to be moved, just because it was finals week, they refused. We came back and asked for it to be moved as a disability accommodation and got general counsel at the university involved. And so that was approved. The same hearing officer was hearing unrelated cases that stemmed from some of the same types of issues of other students. And so, you know, Jordan asked that a hearing officer who did not have any interaction with the other student or any of the witnesses previously be assigned to the case. And that was denied as well. And at the end, next slide. So those are really part of the Title IX matters, Title IX regulations that weren't followed appropriately. As I said, I just go down through here again at what those failures were, so that you have it all in one place. All the failures that we've talked about, both under 504, the ADA, Title IX, and also the school's own policies and procedures were brought to the attention through this appeals process. And thankfully, Jordan was successful in that appeal. He was able to come back to school. And, you know, it's never exciting to have a client who's done something who's been subjected to a process that's hurt them. But it is very rewarding when they do come to you and that's happened, when you're able to work with a major university to change the way they silo their student services offices. So after the appeals officer came back and overturned not just the sanctions, but overturned the findings, we were able to come together with the school and figure out first for Jordan and then how they could do that more broadly, try to prevent this from happening in the future for students with disabilities. Next slide, please. And this is what some of those things were that we worked on. So including behavioral accommodations at intake, again, realizing that accommodations and academic adjustments can go outside of those typical academic curriculum focus type accommodations that we're used to, provide some disability specific faculty and staff training when appropriate, helping faculty that are involved in the Title IX process, and certainly investigators and hearing officers whose only job on campus is to be part of the Title IX process, that they understand common disability-related behaviors of the types of disabilities that their students on campus might have. Coordination proactively between Title IX office and disability services. Again, the ability to for a flag to be raised either for the Title IX office or the student conduct office that a student's registered with the disability services office is hugely important and can have such a positive impact. And then, of course, initiating that interactive process early on. So despite the fact that Jordan was repeatedly asking for reasonable accommodations, he was just getting back no's, without any of that engagement with the student or the disability services office to really modify supports, modify accommodations before some sort of discipline or exclusion was considered. Next slide, please. And again, this is just a tool for you all to have if you would like to look through kind of specifically what grounds for appeal look like, what some major procedural failures can be, how to identify bias, and takeaways from that. Next slide, please. So at the end of the day, it's really important that Title IX and Disability Student Service offices coordinate with each other. And this is not reinventing the wheel. So Title IX is already coordinating with student conduct at every university, certainly every university that I've ever either worked with or had a student in. So it's not that different. It's easy, really, and even the computer programs that the schools use to house this information, to put those red flags in place. Accommodations for a student might look like a modified hearing format, support persons, extended breaks, not having a hearing last a full day, only doing so many hours of a hearing a day, and also alternative questioning formats. So instead of having a student be asked questions by the hearing officer live, you know, the hearing officer could provide their list of questions to the student beforehand. The student could answer them in the hearing, and of course, the hearing officer could ask follow-up questions, but at least that way, their processing is able to take place in a modified way. OCR guidance does require disability-informed procedures, though unfortunately does not give much guidance on what that looks like. And I guess the last piece is, you know, if you looked at my client's school file, that hearing probably did appear procedurally valid on paper. But it certainly was not legally sufficient. And once he was able to tell the whole story of what isn't really shown in the student file, it was clear that it needed to be overturned. One question is about, are objections permitted at the hearing? Absolutely not. Most schools have a code of conduct for the advisors and for the parties that says that no objections can be raised at the hearing. Typically, you're getting all the evidence and information before the hearing, and you do have the opportunity to raise concerns and objections to the materials prior to the hearing. And then the appeals process allows you that ability to come back and say that something is a procedural violation that is one of the bases that you can appeal on. Next slide, please. And this is just a reminder that even if a student is not involved in a Title IX disciplinary process, there are these general disciplinary protections under just basic due process ideals that we have. Certainly public universities have that as government actors, but most private schools include these guarantees of due process in their student handbook. And so if they don't follow them, there's typically some sort of a quasi-contract claim against them. Next slide, please. Okay. If a student comes to you and this perhaps isn't your practice area, or it's a student who's in your life for some other reason, and you see that it's a student with a disability, and for whatever reason, Disability Services has not been involved. The student hasn't talked to them. It's clear the school hasn't talked to them. And there's an academic integrity or other disciplinary matter going on. You definitely, that's a big red flag. This is a student who really needs help. Once you're in a case, you have to be really critical of the individuals involved and whether they could be displaying bias or lack of training. And then, of course, the support and accommodations piece. If a student tells you they've asked for those things and they've been denied, that's a big red flag that they could use some help as well. Next slide, please. If you are working with students in this situation, the biggest thing up front is to push for coordination, demand those individualized assessments, make sure that accommodations are not just happening in a classroom, but there are ways for those to happen procedurally. And remember that you're not just looking at case law when you're thinking about Title IX or Section 504, either one. You also want to be looking at guidance and resolutions that have come out of the Office for Civil Rights. Next slide, please. These are kind of the biggest, most often things that I see from institutions that they could cure proactively. And I've worked with some schools on trying to implement processes and best practices so that these don't happen. Denying support persons, rigid code enforcement, not doing any sort of a behavioral assessment as part of those temporary immediate suspensions, and just the overall lack of staff training. Next slide, please. Okay, and then I just want to give you a kind of a little update of what's going on in general. So before I do that, one more question. If you lose a Title IX appeal, is there a right to review by a state court or a state agency? There's no right to review, no. So if you lose the case, lose the appeal inside the school's administrative process, you could certainly file a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights. You could that the school didn't follow Title IX in their processes or procedures, and that therefore, you know, made gender discrimination happen. And you can file court cases, you know, under Title IX as well and under Section 504. The challenge is that the standard to show a violation that leads to liability is very, very high. But certainly, while there's no said right of appeal, there's no right of review, you can certainly appeal those by filing a new action that attacks the process by which the decision and the appeal were made. Okay, so as I have talked about repeatedly, and I'm sure you all know, OCR's capacity is shrinking. But again, those career enforcement staff, they remain strong. There were new revised Title IX rules that came out last summer, but those were vacated by a federal court, and this administration isn't proceeding to fight that in any way. So the 2020 Title IX rules are in place. Section 504 regulations, they haven't had a rewrite since, I believe, 1974. Department of Ed was taking comments about that under the previous administration, but under this administration, there's not been any updates. So it hasn't been pulled back, but they also haven't made any progress. Next slide, please. And that's really just to wrap up. You know, if you are a student or have a student, you want to make sure before they go to college and throughout the process that they understand their rights, that they're advocating for themselves early on, and that they understand the process, both in academic integrity, student conduct, and Title IX. For parents, you really have to support your students in navigating that self-advocacy and encouraging your student to have documentation of all disability-related needs, especially in preparation for school. Institutions, it's really about proactive collaboration, pulling down those silos. Schools are already doing that in so many ways. And so it's really easy just to include disability services into those processes. And then for attorneys, you know, when you have a case come in that is about a student who's having some sort of issue with a disciplinary process or a Title IX process, asking the question, are you a student registered with disabilities with the university? And then advising clients about how to use the investigative process and how to file grievances if they want to self-advocate. And that's all I have for you today. Thank you so much for being here. We are right at the time, but certainly if anyone has any other questions they want to enter into the question box, I'm happy to answer those. All right, seeing none, I will just say thank you so much for having me here today. If something pops up that you want to talk about later, don't hesitate to reach out to me. I do work on these matters around the country and for, you know, both institutions and students, and I'm always happy to have these conversations. So thank you so much.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information. You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.